we might already know the subject. Oh, forgiveness, yeah, that's first-level stuff, right? Elementary information. But the fact is, there is a lot more to say on that than you realize. And those who are not Christians but are seeking God may not know anything about forgiveness. So our purpose here is to give us all a better understanding of this subject. Why is that? Well, because of what is at stake here, honestly. That's really what I want to appeal to you on tonight. Tonight's just an overview. We're not going to get into all the heady stuff. That's later on. But we are going to get into it. And I just want you to keep in view, right in front of you, what is at stake here. If anyone leaves this earth who is unforgiven by God, then he or she is in a perilous situation that cannot be rectified now that they've left this earth. Okay, so whatever needs to happen between you and God has to happen here and now. And also, what we do with each other, how we forgive or whether we forgive, or even if we don't forgive, that also has an impact on our relationship with God. Let's think about those two things. There's that vertical relationship we have with God that needs to be intact, but then there's that horizontal relationship with God that directly affects that vertical relationship. Kind of like what Jesus says, you know, you need to love God with all your heart and soul and mind, but you need to love your neighbor as yourself. Those two things are inseparable from each other. So when you think about forgiveness in that light, you're thinking about two things here that are inseparable from each other. How we are a forgiving people to one another, that's one aspect. But then being forgiven by God, that's another aspect. And you can't tear these things apart. You can't pull them apart and separate them. There's a lot to say. There's a lot at stake here. So one other thing, as we get into introductory comments here, that I need to say something about the title here, because the title is called The Truth About Forgiveness. The Truth About Forgiveness. The reason why I'm bringing this up is because our nation, if you haven't noticed, is falling into moral decay because two things, truth and honesty, are increasingly being devalued or being redefined to accommodate some political or social agenda. So people are taking these words like truth and honesty, and they're just redefining them and just destroying the integrity of those words. And so here we come along and talk about the truth of forgiveness, and then what someone might get from that is, well, here's my truth on forgiveness for what it's worth. With all due respect, I'm not really interested in your truth on forgiveness. And with all due respect from you to me, you should not be interested in my truth on forgiveness. What we should be interested in is what is the truth on forgiveness, and God alone is the one who provides that truth. So the truth about forgiveness is not a popular subject because it would be much more attractive if this lesson was called Our Feelings on Forgiveness, right? And we probably get a lot more people here. And the reason we didn't get so many people is because, you know, we're just simply being honest and we're peddling something that is not very attractive to people as they might see that. But the fact remains, you can feel anything you want about forgiveness, about the subject of forgiveness, but nothing really matters in this life or the next until you come to the terms with the truth about it. Not your truth, not my truth, not this church's truth or our collective consensus truth, but God's truth about forgiveness. And for this reason, I have to say that this series is not going to be filled with a bunch of heartwarming anecdotes, not a bunch of tear-jerking stories. It's not a Hallmark Channel version, okay? I know we're so used to that. And by the way, there's books on all that. If you want books on forgiveness that has all this, you know, the tear-filled anecdotes and stories and all that, if you're into that, they're out there, okay? But we're not going to do that. What we're after here is what's called practical theology. I know that's a big word there or a big phrase, but all I mean by that is theology, doctrines of God, that are practicable. How do we take that word, that message, theology, and actually put it into real life? Now, if that's interesting to you, or if you're interested in pursuing that, well, then you're going to find this series very valuable to yourself and to others. So practical theology is really what we're looking at. The nuts and bolts, the mechanics of forgiveness. What does God say on the subject? Why does forgiveness work? How can God offer that? What does he do in order to make that real, okay? So there's several things to recognize concerning the study of forgiveness and this particular series on forgiveness. First of all, you'll find out that this is a huge subject. This series will barely scratch the surface, even though there's a lot of stuff I'm going to say. There's just so much more to say. So don't expect every facet of forgiveness to be analyzed and every possible scenario to be answered. I will do my best to do so. We do have a question and answer period Sunday morning, by the way, if you're able to come to that. I'm just going to offer an opportunity for you to ask their questions, and I'll do my best to answer those if I can. Secondly, forgiveness is a highly emotional subject. Virtually everyone has a reason to forgive or to exercise forgiveness, and yet not everyone is willing to do so because, as you well know, emotions often get in the way, complicate things there, especially those emotions of anger and fear. And by the way, that works both ways, for the one seeking forgiveness as well as the one who is meant to offer that forgiveness. It works both ways, okay? And we'll talk about that in later lessons. Forgiveness is often an avoided subject, largely because we struggle with it. We don't know how to deal with that, or maybe we don't want to deal with it. Maybe something's happened to us that is very painful, uncomfortable. And you know what we're after in today's societies? We want things to happen right away. Everyone wants the little magic pill or the little Bible verse or the little anecdote or a little something that can be said that makes everything better instantly, right? And forgiveness doesn't work like that. It doesn't happen like right away. In other words, it's not always immediately rewarding. You can forgive someone, and it can be a most profound act in your whole life to forgive someone of something they did to you, and you may not necessarily feel well doing that. You may not necessarily feel this great euphoria. And so there's a need then on many people's part to seek that immediate gratification, and then they don't find it, and then therefore forgiveness seems to be pointless to them. It's a difficult subject to remain objective in. We can't forget either that it is a theological subject, and that means it's doctrinal, and that means we have to go into the doctrine or the teachings of God in order to determine what it really is. We could sit here all night if you want to and talk about our opinions about forgiveness. I know a lot of churches do that. You know, some preacher gets up here and says, well, forgiveness to me is, and then he goes on with what it means to them, and then someone in the audience says, well, to me it's, and then someone else, to me it's, and we can do all that, but we're not going to get anywhere. Because then all we've done is just thrown out our opinions and our feelings and our particular emotional place wherever we're at, and we haven't really accomplished anything objectively. Forgiveness is not a subject that is left to the therapist, to the psychologist, to the moralist to determine how and when, to what degree, etc. Here's the thing, and this is really important. God has already said what forgiveness ought to look like, and he's already defined forgiveness in the way it ought to be practiced. It is up to us not to reinvent that or redefine that, but rather to simply go into that, investigate, and discover what he has said. That's really our mission here. Okay? Not to get together and collectively decide on our own what it should be, but simply to go back to the Word of God. We've been told to err is human, to forgive is divine, which indicates that forgiveness is not natural. It contradicts the human pride and selfishness and self-preservation that every person has within them. If you do something against me, my first instinct as a human, maybe not as a Christian, but as a human being, is to bristle and you know, kind of steel myself for preserving my position and to save and preserve whatever I can about myself. That's our instinct as people. Again, our Christian beliefs might modify and condition that, but that is our instinct. The theory of evolution has no explanation for forgiveness. Just as it has no explanation for love or hate, guilt or mercy or forbearance, gratitude, emotions of any kind. So a lot of people are stuffing evolution down our throat and saying, well, the world just evolved, it just happened, we're just here by accident, you're just a bunch of mutations, you know, over eons of time, and that's what we're being fed. And then at the same time, turning around and talking about the value of love and the need for forgiveness and need to be socially responsible, these two things cannot go together. It is not natural to forgive. It is not biological to forgive. It is not survival of the fittest to forgive. That has nothing to do with it. Forgiveness is something that is really beyond us, as something that we did not come up with ourselves. Okay, Human forgiveness is a human exercise, something unique to humans. It's not something that trees and mountains and oceans and animals and computers and automobiles do. No other earthly form of life practices forgiveness or is expected to forgive. In fact, if you look in your Bible, not even angels are forgiven or do forgive. So this is something peculiar to people with regard to human forgiveness, that is, okay? I know God forgives us, and there is something divine with that. We'll discuss that, of course. But we're talking about simply what we do with each other here. And when exercised correctly, and by correctly I mean biblically, forgiveness is an act of love, an act of compassion, and also an act of faith. It's not so much something you have to do as it is something that you choose to do. And in doing so, you imitate God, and something that you want to do because it pleases God. And despite all the positive virtues of forgiveness, it is still difficult, sometimes the most difficult thing we are asked to do. And we still struggle with it because forgiveness does not take the path of least resistance. It takes really the path of most resistance. In fact, what most people want instead of forgiveness, is they want justice instead. Okay? We'll talk about that in due time here. So it begs a question then, what does it mean to forgive? And I'm talking here now about forgiving one another here. What does it mean for me to forgive you or for you to forgive me? And not everyone has the same answer. Unfortunately, a lot of times it's left up to personal opinions. For some people, it depends on how they were hurt. And we can be hurt in a number of different ways. We can be hurt by disappointment or rejection or abandonment or ridicule, humiliation, betrayal, being victims of fraud or deception, various forms of abuse, emotional, physical, mental abuse, all kinds of different things that can happen to us. And I would wager that every single person in this audience here has been the victim of someone else's crime, someone else's misconduct, someone else's wrongdoing. Okay, you have been wronged in some way. Every single person here, I would wager here, if we needed to substantiate that, we'd ask for a raising of hands, and we're not going to do that, okay? Just understand that it just depends how we are hurt as to how we can forgive. Some things are real easy to forgive. Other things are very difficult. For others, it depends on who hurt us. Now there's a relational factor, okay? The closer you are to someone and then that person hurts you, the harder it is to forgive them. If a perfect stranger does something to you, for whatever reason, it seems like it's almost easier to forgive that person than it is the person who is closer, because the betrayal or the level of betrayal is more intense with that closer person. So who hurt us? Was it our parents, our siblings, our friends, a best friend, a lover, a spouse, an ex-spouse, children, grandchildren, a coworker, a teacher, a religious leader, a peer, a stranger, the system, the church, God himself, or so people think. We'll talk about that later. Or maybe we even think ourselves, you know, like we hurt ourselves and we need to forgive ourselves. So again, the level of closeness affects that forgiveness factor. And yet still others, is just the idea of being hurt is so traumatic, so intensely personal. It doesn't matter the size or the source. It just matters that I was wronged and now I demand justice and perhaps some compensation, preferably financial, okay? So that's how people are thinking now, okay? In many cases, it's just that I was wronged and someone's got to pay, whether they pay financially or in another form, but they've got to pay there. There's got to be some justice. The first response to an injury or a crime, as I said, is self-protection. And then what we feel is fear and anger and justice and often retaliation. So there's a series of things that go on in our mind when we are offended, when we are betrayed, when we are violated in some way, when we are abused. We want to respond to that in some manner. And I'm talking about in a general way here. I'm not talking about Christians versus non-Christians. I'm just simply talking about a human response to what happened. We tend to want mercy and leniency for ourselves, but we want justice for others. I can prove this, actually. And I've said this before, but driving down Kent Kangley is like taking your life into your own hands. Has anyone noticed that? Okay. So, but notice when someone else makes a mistake, okay, it's different than when you make one. Like when you turn in front of someone, you're like, ooh, sorry, my bad. You know, it's no big deal. When someone turns in front of you, you kind of wish you had a 50 cal machine gun on the front end of your car there and you could just take them out, right? I mean, it's just completely different level here. It's like, and then they're an idiot. And then they, where did they learn to drive? And they probably don't have a license. And who knows what, you know, all these other things that you come up with. When you did the same thing was okay. Well, at least you minimized it and justified it. When they did it, however, it was an atrocious crime that needs to be rectified. And we're like that. I know I'm being facetious when I say all that, but we're like that, aren't we? We want mercy for ourselves. We want justice for everyone else. And that's a problem with us people. That's a problem that we have. And that's a problem that can be reconciled or rectified, I should say, but it's a problem nonetheless. We could counter-argue all this and say getting hurt is a part of the human existence. It's part of growing up. It's part of life. And therefore, to live with the idea that anyone or everyone who wrongs you needs to be brought to trial, brought to justice, that's unreasonable. That's unrealistic. And quite frankly, it's immature. I'm not giving people license to go out and offend other people. I'm not saying that, but I'm just simply saying, let's be realistic about this here. Someone says, well, I don't want all crimes brought to justice, just the ones that hurt me deeply. Well, then the question is, well, which ones are those exactly? And who gets to decide that? How am I supposed to know what hurts you deeply or vice versa? I mean, how are we supposed to know all this? And by the way, this is a subjective and arbitrary thing, just like all pain and hurt and suffering can be. Two people can experience the exact same thing, but experience it very differently. We all know that. And when we're talking about pain of hurt, or whether it's emotional or physical, you know, we can experience those things very differently. So it's a subjective thing. One person gets a little poke in the arm and it's like, okay, it hurt. But another person gets the same poke and they're just distraught and overcome with pain and need some kind of, you know, rehabilitation, okay? So we're looking at this and going, what happened here? Well, it's because it's a subjective situation. We may view the same process very differently. What we are realizing very quickly, I think, is that forgiveness is a complex subject, not one that is simple and easy to understand. I need to say this here at this point. The only biblical or legitimate purpose for forgiveness is sin and sin alone. And here we get into a subject that, again, extremely unpopular because people don't want to talk about sin anymore. They want to talk about, well, I just misspoke, or it was an indiscretion of mine, or, you know, maybe I had a little accident there, or I didn't mean to do that. But to talk about sin carries a certain weight to it, the weight that we don't want to have attached to us. And yet God is very clear on the subject. Again, we'll get into that more in depth later on, but just simply understand that the reason why God wants you to exercise forgiveness is because of sin, nothing else. Sin is a violation or transgression or an act of lawlessness against God, rebellion against him directly or indirectly as demonstrated toward a person. God alone has authority to decide what is or is not sin. It's not something we decide, me, the church, society, or anyone else's, or anyone's hurt feelings or hypersensitive, fragile emotions. That's not what decides what sin is. God is the one who decides. Sin needs to be defined by a higher authority than you or I. We call that a transcendent authority, something that transcends all human beings. The reason for that is because we have to have a standard that doesn't change, that cannot be customized or altered, that cannot be corrupted by human motives or agendas, and that cannot be removed either. Something that is timeless, something that is universal, something that is a righteous standard. And secondly, sin, in order to be sin, has to be, here's a legal term, prosecutable. I know that's technical, but it's applicable here. There needs to be an actual crime committed. It can't just be an imaginary thing like, I think you sinned against me. Well, I either did or I didn't. It can't just be something you imagine or think happened. There has to be evidence for it. It has to be a historical event associated with that. Okay? Something that I did to you, not just something that you imagined that I did to you, or vice versa. It has to be something that can be, if needed, brought before a court of law. And I'm not talking about a human court of law. We're talking really about God's court of law. If I violate God's nature, or if I violate someone who is made in his image, then I am guilty of sin before God. And that has to be dealt with if I'm going to ever stand righteous again before God. That has to be dealt with. But God's the one who determines what that is, or defines what that is. Here's a verse here in 1 John 3:4. John says very bluntly, everyone who practices sin also practices lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness. So we have this clear definition of sin. It's showing a disregard or a lack of care toward God's laws. Think of lawlessness like carelessness. Careless means you don't show care. Lawless means you don't obey law. Okay? You're showing a disregard for that thing. And if God had never given us laws, then we wouldn't know right from wrong. We wouldn't know what is sin or not. But since he has revealed his law, now we are without excuse. We can't ignore that or neglect that or reject that or rebel against that without consequence. We cannot claim ignorance because he's shown us, he's told us what that is. Someone says, well, I haven't learned that yet. Well, you do have a Bible. And I know that everyone has access to a Bible. And if you're here tonight and you don't own a Bible, we'll give you a Bible for free because we want you to know what God says. And so we all have access to the information. And that takes away the excuse then of ignorance. God's holy and divine nature really is a law to us. It's what we call morality. When someone says, talks about morality, what you're really talking about, whether you meant to or not, you're actually talking about what is God? Who is God? What is his divine nature? What is he like? What is true to him and what is not true to him? Anything not true is immoral. By violating his nature, we violate his law. By violating his law, we violate his nature. So to sin against God's law, simply put, means to sin against God himself. Because you can't take the two away from each other. You can't take his nature away from his law because his nature is his law. You're sinning against the same thing. So think about that. Sin is not just some abstract idea out there, and it's not something that happens without consequence. It is something that happens against God and that we are responsible for if indeed we are the sinner. Romans chapter 4, verse 15, Paul says, where there is no law, there is also no violation. Now, obviously, it means no sin. If God had not said what's right or wrong, then we couldn't charge us with anything. But he has said it. Sin is not imputed or charged when there is no law. Chapter 5, verse 13 there. So we can't break or violate what doesn't exist. So think about this. When God charges us with sin, that means that we had to have known, or we should have known, what it was that was violated. He doesn't charge us with sin unless there is a law to break. And that means our actions are measured against a holy standard, a standard that God came up with. James chapter 2, verse 10, James says very clearly, for whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles in one point, he has become guilty of all. And we have that same expression today. If someone goes speeding down Kent Kangley at 80 miles an hour, we don't go and say, he broke the speed limit, as much as we say, he broke the law. It's true he broke the speed limit. But what's also true is he broke the law. It doesn't matter which law, and it doesn't matter how many laws or how often he broke them. He's a violator of law. He's no longer a law keeper. Now he's a law breaker. He broke the law. Well, that's also true with you and me. When you and I violate God's law, we're no longer law keepers. Now we're law breakers. And it doesn't matter which law you broke or how many times or how often and so on. It just simply matters that you broke the law. James is saying that. When you break a law, you broke the law. Because you can't fix it either way. So you don't have to be a flagrant law breaker. You just need to break one law to become a sinner. And that's something a lot of people don't want to recognize because then that means that we're all sinners in as much as we've all broken the law. When people forgive each other, it has to be for the same reason that God forgives us, because sin has been committed. We're told in Genesis 1:27 that God created us in his own image. not merely as a reflection of himself with intelligence and emotions and creativity, the ability to make decisions and to reason, but also as an extension of himself. Not just as a reflection, also as an extension. In other words, when I do something to you, I'm doing something really to God. In as much as I commit some crime against you, I'm really committing that against God, in as much as you and I, as ones made in God's image, are an extension of God. That's something that we should recognize. So when we do something to each other, when we lie to each other, steal from each other, cheat each other, betray each other, hate and harm and murder each other, it's as if we've done these things to God himself. We're showing contempt for that which is made in the image of God. Think of the Ten Commandments, for example. I'm not saying we're bound by the specific Ten Commandments, but we are bound by all the moral commandments of those Ten Commandments there, even the New Testament, such as you shall not steal, you shall not lie, you shall not commit adultery, all those things. Notice that those sins are really against each other. They're against people. And yet the crime is as if it is against God. And that's what we're talking about here. When you violate someone else in whatever way you do, when you violate their human nature, or when you violate that person's trust and sin against them, when you corrupt that relationship you have with them, when you defile them in whatever way, you create a situation wherein you're sinning against God, just as if you had sinned against them. And that's what he's trying to get across to us here. When we sin against each other, we sin against God. We've been told by God how we're supposed to treat one another. By mistreating each other, we sin against the person and disobeying God. Here's 1 Corinthians 8:12. In principle, I say, because Paul is talking about Christ in a context in which deals only with Christians. But he says, by sinning against the brethren, Christians, you sin against Christ. It's the same thing. A Christian is an extension of Christ, not merely a reflection of him, but an extension of him. So when you sin against your Christian brother or sister, you're actually sinning against Christ himself. You say, well, I didn't mean to sin against Christ. Well, it doesn't matter what you meant to. It doesn't matter what you did. So that's something to keep in mind here. And then in Matthew chapter 6, verse 14 and 15, Jesus really brings all that together. For if you forgive others for their transgressions, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive others, then your Father will not forgive your transgressions. Now we're looking at the other side of this, that when someone sins against their fellow man, he sins against someone made in God's image. And when that person who sinned against refuses to forgive, and we're talking about when there is reason for that forgiveness to be offered, another lesson, we'll get to it, when that happens there, and he refuses, now he's saying here, in essence, I don't care about that person who sinned against me, which is another way of saying, I don't care about the God who made that person. I don't care about the godness in that person, a person who is made in the image of God. And that's really sacrilege if you think about it. Jesus is basically saying, why should God show care to you, a lesser being than him, when you're unwilling to show care and compassion to someone who is your equal? That's something to think about there. Why should he show care to you if you're not willing to care about someone who's your equal? What does it mean really exactly to forgive? In essence, your forgiveness is your cancellation of a person's debt for a specific moral crime that is inflicted against you, for which has been, appropriate responsibility has been taken. And in the process of that cancellation of a debt, you are reestablishing the humanity of the one who committed the crime. You're recognizing that people are flawed, they're imperfect, they're prone to error. That's why we make mistakes. That's why we commit crimes. That's why we're selfish as opposed to infallible. Okay? I'm not giving us permission to sin here. What I'm saying is that I'm just recognizing who we are, recognizing that we're all flawed people. And we need to see people then with both eyes, not just the eye of justice, okay, that recognizes a wrong was done, but also with the eye of compassion that says, okay, I realize that this person who did me wrong was indeed wrong to do it, but they're also human like I am. Okay, there's still a humanity about that person. There is that eye of mercy and compassion. Imagine seeing someone, for example, with some kind of, I don't know, disfigurement. Maybe they have leprosy, or maybe they're a burn victim, or maybe they have some kind of a deformity about them. You can't just focus on the outside there. Okay, you have to look beyond that and recognize that underneath all that, there's still a human being that is made in the image of God. And that's exactly what we're talking about. You can't just look at a person and say, you're a sinner, and therefore I abhor you, okay? You have to recognize that underneath that sin, if you will, underneath that error and that humanity that is flawed and imperfect, there's still a person who is made in the image of God, just like you are made in the image of God. And we're simply recognizing that, that beneath the crime, beneath the offense, beneath the disease, if you will, is a human being in need of redemption and salvation and the object of God's love. And with that forgiveness, or through that forgiveness, we reinstate that person to being one of us. We also, who are flawed and imperfect, prone to error. What we're saying in essence there is, I don't agree with what you did, the action itself, but I no longer wish to treat you as something less than myself. We're also releasing that person from a crime, like letting them out of our mental prison that we've kept them in. And that's a hard thing, because in doing so, we relinquish some things. We surrender some things. First of all, the right to get even. We relinquish all desires or plans to seek personal vengeance or retaliation. We don't say things like, I forgive you, but I'm going to hunt you down and make you pay later. Okay, well, those are just two things that just can't go together. We relinquish that right to the other thing when we forgive them. We also relinquish the right to prosecute for the crime committed. We're pardoning as much as we're able to do humanly, so as to not to bring that person to trial, literally or mentally, over and over. Now, the consequences may remain, I'll give you that, but we're not there to simply be judge, jury, and executioner. A lot of you have seen, in fact, I just saw on Facebook recently, this illustration of, you know, the kid that was always angry and, you know, felt like everyone was doing him wrong, and his dad told him to, you know, find a fence post and take these nails and pound them into the fence post. Every time someone does you wrong, every time you get angry at someone, they feel like they've betrayed you, pound the nail into the fence post. Well, pretty soon he had a fence post full of nails. And then the father taught him about forgiveness, and as he learned about grace and mercy and forgiveness, he started taking the hammer and pulling those nails out. Okay, so after a while, all the nails are gone, but the holes are still there. And that's a good point to make. That's an easy illustration to think about here, that the damage is still going to be done. That doesn't mean all the consequences go away, but it does mean that we can relinquish the prosecution here of that individual. The right of justice being served by us is also something we have to surrender. We absorb, in a sense, that loss of justice. The injury cannot be avenged. The wrong will not be made right. The sin will not be punished by us, at least. We give the matter over to God. We let God handle it. We basically say, this thing here, it was wrong, and I want to restore my relationship with this person and reinstate them as a fellow human being, but this thing here, it's too big for me, but God has asked me, when they've come to their senses and pleaded for my forgiveness, he's asked me to forgive them, so I'm going to take this thing and absorb it in myself, but what I'm really going to do is give it over to God, someone that can handle it, someone that can deal with it righteously. We're told in Hebrews chapter 8, verse 12, God saying, I will be merciful to their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more. Now, there's a very specific context to this. He's talking about people who are entering into a covenant relationship with him. I'll talk about that tomorrow night. But the point is that those who God forgives are no longer legally charged with their sins. The stain is removed. The record is purged. It doesn't mean that he literally forgets the sin. That's what everyone thinks from that verse. It doesn't mean that. It simply means he's not going to hold you accountable to what you did. And the same thing goes for us when we forgive someone. We don't any longer hold them accountable to what they did. When possible, we restore the relationship that has been jeopardized or injured or betrayed through the crime that has been committed. This can't be done perfectly among people because memories remain, trust needs to be rebuilt, privileges may be reduced, but we're no longer separated by sin. Okay, we're taking out the thing that separated us there, and that was the sin itself. Forgiveness and restoration sound like the same thing. They're really not. Reconciliation, all these different things sound like the same. They're really not. Forgiveness is the necessary step toward reconciliation or restoration. One must occur. Forgiveness has to occur before the other can happen. You don't reconcile with someone and then forgive them. You forgive them in order to be reconciled or for that relationship to be restored. Reconciliation means to be made friends with again. So if the friendship has suffered because of some injustice, forgiveness is necessary to bring those two people back together again. It's absolutely critical. Something's been done and it needs to be acknowledged. But that relationship, if it's going to be restored as it was, then there has to be a mutual agreement to that. You can't restore half a friendship. Okay? So think about it this way. Suppose a friend steals a lot of money from you. And he's a good friend, and you've known him for a long time, but he stole a whole bunch of money from you. And then he comes to his senses, and he repents of that, and he confesses what he did, and he comes to you and he says, "Will you forgive me?" And you say, "Yes, I will forgive you." Okay, that takes care of the problem. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the friendship that you once enjoyed with him or the trust that you once had with him is automatically restored and that all that just goes away. It doesn't mean that. The problem is dealt with. You did what you had to do. He did what he had to do in order to take care of the sin itself. But the relationship now, that has to be agreed upon by both parties as to whether it's going to be restored or not. I hope I'm really clear on that, because I think there's a lot of confusion on that very point right there, where people are thinking that, you know, because I forgave them, then I have to go back and trust them exactly the same way as I did before, and, you know, everything's going back to normal and all that. It doesn't mean that. That doesn't mean you have a right to just destroy the relationship either. That's would be sinful in yourself. But it does mean that, let's just be honest with what's going on here, okay? Let's be factual and pragmatic about that. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 18 and 19, Paul says here very clearly, now these things are, verse 18. These things are from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. Namely, that God was in Christ, reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and he has committed to us the word of reconciliation, this ministry that he's talking about. So what is he saying here? Well, it's through Christ that we are reconciled to God. Okay? It's through Christ that we are reconciled to God. What does Christ do? He takes care of the problem so that the relationship that we had with God can be restored. We can be made friends with again. Reconciliation is what that is going on there. And that's only possible through the blood of Christ, which we have a lot to say on later on. So in essence, what forgiveness is doing is it's showing mercy and grace to another person as an imitation of the mercy and grace shown to us by God. Mercy is what God withholds from you that you rightly deserve. Grace is what God gives to you that you don't deserve. Every person who sins against him deserves to be punished, and yet God can offer forgiveness instead. And for that reason, on our part, forgiveness is an act of faith that we believe that there is a God, and we believe that God is going to make everything right in the end. And we believe that whatever we give to God, as far as burdens that are too great for us, we believe that God is going to vindicate us. And if someone actually faked their repentance and faked their penitence toward us and faked their confession and just came to us and we bought into that and we were duped in the process, God is going to make that right. And if someone is going to be punished, then it's going to be God who punishes. A lot to say on that, but let's jump ahead here to just as important to in understanding what forgiveness is, we also need to understand what it is not. Here's the big deal. Forgiveness is not forgetting what happened, pretending that it never happened. I have had so many people tell me that over the years. Well, if I forgive them, then I need to just forget it ever happened, and I'm not willing to do that. Who said you had to do that? That's not what it's all about. The reason that forgiveness is offered is because something did happen. In fact, if you're forgiving someone for nothing, then that's pretty pointless, isn't it? So the reason why you're forgiving someone is because something most certainly did happen. And both parties, by the way, in order to be responsible to what happened, have to recognize that the thing happened. It's not forgetting. It's not pretending. It's not, imagining that it just disappears or evaporates. God doesn't pretend anything when he forgives you, does he? He doesn't pretend that it never happened. That doesn't mean he'll hold you accountable to it, but it doesn't mean either that it just evaporates from his mind. He's God. He doesn't forget anything. He knows everything that has happened, good and bad. But whether he holds you accountable to it or not, that's a different situation. He deals with it in the right way for the right reason, and so should you. Forgiveness is not condoning wrong behavior. God never condones sin, and yet he is willing to forgive sinners of every kind. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 9 through 11 there, in verse 9 and 10, Paul lists a whole bunch of deviant crimes and says, in essence, in verse 11, he says, "And you, Corinthians, some of you were those people that I just mentioned. Such were some of you, and yet you were washed, you were justified, you were sanctified in God through Christ and sanctified through God's Spirit." In other words, he condemns the sin, but he forgives the sinner, and that's exactly what we should be doing. We should be condemning the sin, but we should be forgiving the sinner when indeed there's reason to do so. It does not mean that we turn a blind eye to justice. It means that we absorb justice in ourselves in order to give that to God, just as we've been told earlier in this lesson. It doesn't mean that we give up. It doesn't mean we give in. It doesn't mean we admit defeat. God doesn't do that, and we should not do that with others or for ourselves. So forgiveness is not this shoulder-shrugging resignation like, I don't want to do this, but fine, I'll forgive you, just accept defeat there. That's not what this is about. Actually, there's a great victory in forgiveness, if you think about it, rather than defeat and resignation. Forgiveness is not self-martyrdom, this kind of grin and bear it attitude. This is actually a backward form of pride here. It insists that other people take pity on us. Like, you go around saying, "Look what I've had to endure. This person, they hurt me so much. They did so much wrong, but me being the good person that I am, I forgave them. Look at what I've done," right? I mean, it's almost like parading what you've done here before everybody and making yourself smell better than you really do, okay? I hate to put it that way, but that's how it looks. And so there's this idea I sacrificed, I suffered, I endured so much. I deserve your attention. And it's not hard to find this sort of attitude. This is a society that we live in that's creating this and conditioning us to think this way. Forgiveness is not a sign of weakness. It is not a lack of guts to condemn bad behavior, unwilling to take a stand. This is bogus. I can't stress this hard enough. This is bogus. And if you've been around me long enough, you should know that bogus is Latin for baloney, okay? So this thing here is bogus. Which takes more strength, honestly, to hold a grudge, to be bitter, to seek vengeance and retaliation, or to walk with Christ and be willing to suffer wrongs and absorb losses for the sake of a higher, nobler cause than a self-serving life? Which is harder? I would grant to you that the second part is much harder than the first. Anybody can hold a grudge. Anybody can seek retaliation and vengeance. We see all these, in the rest of the world, we're seeing suicide bombers and all these holy wars and things going on here. Listen, it takes nothing at all to engage in that sort of behavior. That is the path of least resistance. God never teaches us to do that. The path of most resistance is to walk in the footsteps of Christ and to do what very few people are willing to do. Christ is the most powerful, noble, dynamic, dignified person to ever walk the face of the earth. And Christ forgives more than any of us. So don't be conned into thinking it's a sign of weakness. I have a lot more to say on this subject here, but I want to be clear. Forgiveness is an area in which many people struggle, and struggle often. As I said, it's not natural to forgive. It's something you have to learn how to do. It's not something that you just wake up one day and go, "Oh, I know everything about forgiveness, and I'm going to do it perfectly." But it's not something everyone is going to do rightly or for the right reason or in faith. We're told in 1 John chapter 4, verse 1, that many false prophets have gone out into the world, and you would do well not to listen to just anybody who starts spouting off about forgiveness, myself included, by the way. You would do well not to listen to those people, just because of their their status or whatever clout they think they have. Really, the greatest teacher of all is Jesus Christ, as we'll see in our series. And by imitating Christ, we suddenly realize that we no longer need to cling to the world's anger and hatred and resentment and grudges and self-pity. We don't have to cling to that anymore. Let the rest of the world do that if they want to. We don't have to do that anymore. You don't have to do that anymore. And we don't have to take on a responsibility of judge, jury, and executioner. And by saying that, I want to be real clear, it doesn't mean we don't care about what's right or wrong. It doesn't mean that. But it means we're not in charge of righting everything that is wrong or everyone who is wrong. It doesn't mean that we're in charge of all that. Punishing the penitent for their wrongs against us does not make us better people. When someone comes to us and says, I confess, I did this, it was wrong, will you forgive me? And we sit there with arms folded and go, no, I don't think so, okay? When we do that, it might make us feel good for the moment, give us that little rush of giddy excitement and adrenaline and everything else, but it doesn't heal the pain. It doesn't satisfy the loss that is incurred. God makes us better people when we choose to live in God's way. That's the only way you're going to be a better person, is to choose to live according to the will of God. We should recognize, too, that our time on earth is short and precious, and so make the most of it. Don't waste it on grudges and bitterness and vengeance. We're also told in James chapter 4:8, draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Well, this is impossible if we're all self-absorbed and lost in our own hurt and wallowing in what happened to us and relishing our anger and all those other things. You can't walk with God and stew in the bitterness of the world at the same time. You've got to choose which way you're going to go. And whether you and I place a high value on forgiveness, whether God's or your own, is up to each one of us. No one's twisting your arm. But remember what I said earlier. In the end, when you leave this world and enter into the world to come, and you, by the way, will do that. Everyone sitting here will do that. When that happens, whether or not you are forgiven by God will be of supreme importance. Maybe not right now at this moment. You might be able to wave this off, shrug this off, you know, leave here tonight going, well, whatever. When you are there in that moment, on the other side, you will think of nothing else but whether or not you were forgiven by God. And the only opportunity you have to do anything about it is right now in this life. Think wisely. In the end, whether or not you have a forgiving heart will also be of supreme importance. But now is the time when you have to do something about that. This is the only opportunity you have to deal with that right now. I'm not saying this is a threat. I'm not saying this is a scare tactic. I'm saying this is a fact, and it's a fact that is not going to go away. It doesn't matter who in this world does or does not forgive you, but it does make all the difference in the world whether or not God forgives you and whether or not your heart is transformed by his forgiveness. That's all I got for tonight. I mean, I could go longer, but that's all I got for tonight. Now, we have lots more to say. I would encourage you, if you're interested in pursuing this subject, then please continue with us through this series as we continue in our study on the truth of forgiveness. I'm going to turn it over now to Richard. Thank you.